Blog Talk Radio.
Good day. And welcome to the place where you're always welcome and where we want to make you feel that you belong. This is, of course, Masonic Home Companion on the 25th of August, 2013, the 237th day of the year. I hope since I've last spoken to you, you were all overwhelmed by the meteor showers that happened earlier this month. Fabulous. The celestial references in, we're going to talk about a little bit today in Freemasonry, have always been there, always been with us. Well, I want to talk a little bit today and get some advice from you, as usual. About things Masonic and things important in the development of what we are and who we are. So if we, for those of you who have thought of Freemasonry as putting on a magic cloak and making you somehow a wonderful reinvented creature, well, I'm here to tell you you're the same boy you always were. There's no free lunch. If you're going to progress, it does take a bit of work, and here we're going to try and make it interesting and let you know that we have some common goals in sight, and they're not going to fall into our laps. unless our work improves. Oh my goodness. There we go with that sense of self-improvement again. Where in the world does that come into it? Well, it comes into it because a good mentor, when we're very fortunate and we connect with a good mentor, we know the quality of the mentor's thinking. We also know the shortcomings of our mentors. That's part of the learning process. It's part of paying attention. So if we're seeing anybody around us that we think walks on water, we should probably give our heads a shake. We have to be able to be frank, realistic, and objective, don't we? That's the essence of moving ahead in a truthful, authentic way. So in return for that, we see people, an ability to see people like that requires an ability to see ourselves like that, the unvarnished history, warts and all. And at the end of the day, warts and all, we're not too darn bad, you know? There's that, we're strengthened, embodied in a way by that kind of candor and honesty. I've been thinking and noticing things. My goodness, it's impossible not to notice things when you start to study the history of this remarkable order. You know how we've been challenged over the years about, you've heard it, that Freemasonry is a religion, and it's crossed my horizon. I was out slumbering on the porch, and one of my eyelids fluttered open temporarily, and this came past me. So that's the idea that, and maybe ponder for a second the validity of that, but I noticed something about religion. Either it's very passive, you know, it's like me buying a set of golf clubs and saying, there, I'm a golfer, but not taking them out of the bag, joining a club or learning how to use them properly. That's a very passive kind of form, and I think religion can be that way. And the other end seems to be very extreme. You know, the zealots, they're so ridiculous that they cause friction and conflict wherever they go, all in the name of, oh, well, they distort. Again, I think it's a tremendous distortion, but along comes this thing that's neither, this thing where the achievement is likeness of mind, fraternity, and balance, neither passive nor zealous, but active. And when you ask yourself, what's in the middle of the difference between those two? It's being active, being engaged, having a meaningful connection. And that's what the order affords us. Doesn't make us, doesn't tell us. It affords the opportunity. Now, I've been, you know, when I harbor some really, I think, perplexing thoughts at times when I think that, you know, I know that there are people who are on the fringes of Freemasonry, tend to, you know, use the Constitution in terms of convenience and things like that. They have their own reasons, but it seems the perplexing part seems like I'm not too sure if using the Constitution isn't understanding it, not using it, understanding it isn't part of the development and progress of character. I'm perhaps some of you out there can help me with that. I certainly don't know. I mean, it's important enough to me that I'm not ready to dismiss it just yet. I wanted to, today, as you know, we were talking about the topic du jour. It was a Mason without context is light without darkness. I thought that might another observation. You know, if a Mason is operating disconnected, then it's like how do you achieve any kind of lightness? There's no contrast. There's nothing. You're just sort of self-declaring. Huh. The final mystery is oneself. When one has weighed the sum in the balance and measured the steps of the moon and mapped out the seven heavens star by star, there still remains oneself. Who can calculate the orbit of his own soul? So said Oscar Wilde. That dilettante, that person that was out to be an affront to the pomposity and hubris of his time, went overboard and was jailed. Sounds a little dodgy the way it all happened today. He was jailed, came out of prison after a couple of years and died alone and penniless in obscurity in Paris. Very sad. But in his day, he was a remarkable playwright. Doubtful that we can begin to understand the nature of Freemasonry as long as we accept vague effort, lowering the standard. In fields of serious study, understand findings we refer to as to a context, to understand, understanding findings. We refer to all of that. Renaissance thought was a breakthrough challenge to the bullying of religion and politics that was able to exercise enough support to cajole the public to comply. During the Renaissance, mankind became irrevocably evidence-based. I say irrevocably because it began to fill in some serious gaps. The consistency of mathematics and science gave mankind an entire new way to think. We have inherited that, my brethren and guests. And so today, we're going to share with you more of the amazing work from And if you're fortunate enough to get a copy of this, Henry Wilson Coyle Sr.'s work on Freemasonry through six centuries, really quite a remarkable piece of research. I was noticing, had the good fortune to be doing some work on the upcoming arrangements for the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry. It's coming to Canada for the first time, to St. Catharines, into the Niagara area, of course, because of the richness of Canadian history, not to mention the war that defined a nation, the 1812, what was the outcome of that? I think it had something to do with kicking somebody's ass, but anyway, I digress. The arrangements are moving ahead, and the complication here isn't whether we can pull enough together. It's that there's an abundance. There's an abundance of things to do. When you think about an international audience or people coming from the rest of Canada or the rest of the United States or South America, Europe, how do you tailor it down for a few days and then allow opportunity to pursue learning at the highest level achievable right now? Well, that's the very pleasant task that sits before the organizing committee. Can you imagine? Not to mention the Charlie Sankey collection. This is all about, it's not all. He was a collector. A lot of scientists are. He was a collector. And he was a details kind of fellow. And he pulled together a collection of some of the most remarkable and, I guess today, obscure writings on Freemasonry and gave them to a library that had the commitment to put them into, to preserve them. And now, it brings scholars from all over the world, and hopefully Masonic scholars like you and I, to the door to read and learn from those earlier documents. And so, how long would it take for you and I to go through a library like that? What would you want to spend? A week? A month? What does it justice when you start reading and become distracted? But this is like a sampler. We're going to have to somehow let people know what's there and turn that over to the archivists. The beauty of the Niagara area in the spring, and of course, one of the eight wonders of the world, Niagara Falls, and of course, then the world-renowned wine districts and, the hospitality of Canada. We're a nation that, unlike other nations, we know how to laugh. And when you listen to the music that is inherent to Canada, it is lively, engaging. It's a celebration. And this is maybe the celebration of renewal and opportunity that's still with us. We have this huge, beautiful nation, and it's underpopulated still. But the people that are here appreciate the land. We appreciate the sunrise, the sunsets, everything about our country. When you appreciate the land, then we know that, when you see a kid that's grown up, just been here for a couple of years, out playing shinny with his hockey stick and his buddies, then you know that there's a new generation coming. Because once upon a time, that was us. And before us, it was our great-grandfathers. And at least now, we have the greatness of the Leafs. No, that's we're an odd little nation. Our oldest sports franchise teaches us character. I hope you're sitting down. Put your drink down so you don't spill it laughing when you hear this. Our achievement in sports, if you're a Leafs fan, isn't about winning. It's about being a Leafs fan. And if you're a Canadian football fan, it's being part of the Riders Nation. You are part of it. Good, bad, a little bit of bruising, a little dust, doesn't matter. Win, lose, doesn't matter. If you're not part of the Leafs crowd, well, whatever, what are you? What's wrong with you, man? Winning? That's for some other country. We're not into that stuff here. We don't waste our time. I love it, don't you? Now you think about it. Is that liberating? Is that liberating? We don't go moping around. It's like, hey, the magic lasts until they're off the ice, and every spring they're on the golf courses a little earlier. Hey, but they did scare us last year. They did look pretty seriously, so I'm here to tell you this is going to be our year, boys. Anyway, things Masonic. How about we pick up where we left off on the with the manners of oaths and things like that. Are you ready for a little bit of this? I'm not quite sure whether, you know, I hear that might be a little dry for some of us today, but I'll we can come at it again. You know, I'll get back to that. And I'm probably speaking to the I want to speak to the Epicureans in the crowd. You know, the people that are able to, you know, you keep in mind that there's so many opportunities for conflict over, you know, trivia. And I keep in mind that some of the finest pacifists that I've ever met in the world have been soldiers, battle-worn soldiers. They do so much to avoid the battle and avoid, you know, losing their mates and on both sides in every conflict. Those are, to me, the supreme pacifists. And that's the, you know, and I'm led to believe otherwise, but it's usually by, you know, armchair, Rosenkavalier, as the opera taught us. You know, it's easy to puff up and wear braid when I'm not being faced with that kind of conflict. God bless those men and women that do that. But those are probably the finest pacifists on the planet. They teach us a lesson that we should avoid this type of thing at all costs. And I like to think that's what Freemasonry has developed. We've developed a way of making the world a better place, making our communities a better place, but really reducing conflict. So when we hear about the peaks and quarrels, you hear the lamentations of different grand masters over the years. It's really us that has to achieve that. It's not going to happen again, that notion of being passive and sitting back. Well, maybe. I don't want to admit or confirm Andrew Hammer's thinking, but it's hard to ignore some of his thinking that we're accepting some standard work, that it's all right to just do whatever you want and do your own thing. And well, not if our commitment to you is to be true. Our commitment to you is to, and to each other, is to help with that idea of improvement by example, of course. But if we make it seem like it's tedious, if we make it seem like it's an intrusion, then what's the problem? Is somebody else out there critiquing the history of Freemasonry? Well, I'm not quite one of them. If I saw a man doing that, I would think either he's I'll be kind and say he's very naive. You would have to have a lifetime plus of learning, I think, in order to even understand the boundaries, the edges of the Masonic philosophy. there is a difference between a Freemason and a Mason, in my mind. Mason can dress up, can have the golf clubs in the trunk of his car and never take them out, and call himself a golfer. But I'm more concerned, serious-minded men would never say something like that, would never claim that you know, these things about Freemasonry don't matter. Not serious-minded men. Maybe foolish fellows could get away with it. But our conflict seems to be where we become rather deliberate. We'll just move away from those ideas. We don't entertain them. That's where somebody that's really struggling and unhappy is going to be isolated inside our order, isn't he? Until he accepts the hand that's being offered to him. It's a little more, it's part of a learning curve for some fellows. Some jump in and say, oh yeah, this is great. I've been waiting for it all my life. Others, it seems like there's a hesitance. It's like, I'm not sure what's going on, but I'm sure I'm not going to trust you. Well, after all, when you came in blindfolded, it's clumsy to say, but the trust was a big issue in the rebirth of a man. And facing the unknown. The unknown meaning the script's being rewritten. You know? Ah, oh, dear. Anyway, let me get on with the remarks in the Gothic Constitution. So I hope you're tuning into the Grand Lodge website, and you'll see under the Grand Senior Warden, you see some of the travels. You are invited, of course, to any of the talks that I'm giving. The more, the better. I've got one going on at Ivy Lodge down in Grimsby on the 1st of October, and it's going to be, let's say, well attended. But the hospitality of those fellows is incredible, and so if you're inclined, and then over to Spry Lodge in Beaton, and that's coming up, I think, on the 28th of September. If you're inclined, we're going to be talking about things old and dusty and Masonic, and Ancient Charges is going to be the kernel, the focus for that one too. And then of course this Wednesday, people in Elmvale at Coronation Lodge are hosting a Grand Lodge officers doing a degree work. So barbecue before that, and great. Lots of events happening as the summer begins to wrap up, and we jump into our gear and get ready for many of us for the after being sort of slumbering over the summer, getting right back into it with gusto, especially where the installations have happened in June. Then you're looking at the new Masters of the Lodge demonstrating their preparation. So be there or be square. Remarks on the Catholic Constitution. The old constitutions are alike in these respects. These charges that we have now rehearsed unto you all and all others that belong to me, since you shall keep, so help you God, and you shall, and your halidom, to help your God and your halidom. Tell me what that means, boys. And by this book in your hands, unto your power, amen. So be it. That's the sort of the, every Mason truly serve the Lord for his pay, and every master truly make an end of his work, be it task or journey. So the remarks in the old constitutions are alike. They virtually all of the old constitutions begin with an invocation. Like I just read, relate substantially the same legends, give charges, and provide for an oath of compliance. They all reflect religious, moral, and ethical precepts and contemplate a brotherhood for mutual helpfulness, designed to benefit the lord or owner of the work no less than the workman. They exhibit many peculiarities and differences, some of which are as follows. Now, this is getting into the voices of our Masonic ancestors talking to us from what, 15th century? If you're inclined to follow the history of Masonry in Scotland. And maybe I should talk about an interesting link, a curious link, about this fellow James Anderson, a Scottish guy that was acknowledged as being the author of the Anderson Constitution. We'll relook at that, and I'll talk to you a little bit about some of the history and the findings. And what this does to our thinking. When new history, that's an interesting slip of the tongue. When we discover, our researchers discover things that are new and verifiable that we didn't know before, it's likely, as it always does, to change our popular opinions. Now, what does that do? Let's scratch our heads. A professor of theology over at Queen's University was giving a lecture at Templum Fidelis, and I happened to ask him about the scripture because he was talking about how exciting things were in theology. The new findings were helping rewrite scriptures and have put it in a different context. And fascinating for a person who studies this and has made it their life's ambition. And he's telling us that he explained very clearly that he doesn't direct his students to King James Version because that's quite a dated document. It was written to update other previous Bibles that were outdated, I guess you could say, replaced by something with a more accurate context. And he was explaining that, they've gotten now the science of this work has taken to within 200 years of the birth of Christ instead of, 2,000 years. So you can sort of judge to yourself which is the more accurate, the one that is moving things forward to within 200 years of the birth. Or I'm thinking about this one, of course, one faith. And it's my own limitations to the Janus and the Islamists, to Hindi brethren, I apologize very profusely. I'm not that I'm not as conversant, and if I had something verifiable to say, but let me say this: I am pretty sure that there are parallels in all of the great faiths of the world. That the more we know about the history, some of these faiths that I just mentioned predate and antedate. So, it's like, I don't think the faith is written about provenance, the oldest being better, because, if we're getting back into that kind of thinking, old meant that music and rhythm was there before language, and this notion of, a lot of notions were prevalent in ancient faiths that may in some ways be continuing to affect us today. Well, we wouldn't know unless we became students. So the arts and sciences, the second degree that allowed you to, or encouraged you and I to become students of the arts and sciences. Well, I won't ask whether you have or not. If you haven't, it's an opportunity that's at your door, a rare and special opportunity. So let me go back here and get into the constitutions here. You can see that the constitutions, each little bit of the Gothic constitutions has its own context, each and every section. It's like it's like dishes at a banquet, every single one of them being so carefully prepared for us. So we're talking about similarities of all of the Gothic and old constitutions. The first here, the invocation, doubtless to conform to the Roman Catholic creed. You can see the influences in Europe, is Trinitarian Christian. Though there is no indication that such belief was necessary for admittance. There. said as clearly as you possibly can. For the sake of the ritual, for the sake of saying it in some form, with all of the qualifiers, we understand the limits of it. That means we can understand it. The legends are fanciful, abound in anachronisms, and are brief and unfinished in literary workmanship. Several variations in the names of characters are noted, and a few cannot be identified in history. For example, St. Alban and Namus Graecus, whom Fort says means Namus the Greek. Peter Gower is supposed to be Pythagoras. These English legends tell a story of greater antiquity than the German or French legends, which go back only to the time of Diocletian in the 3rd century. The Regius manuscript differs from the others in beginning the legends with that of Euclid. It and most of the others mention the patronage of the craft by Charles Martel as it passed through France, through the Cook manuscript, though the Cook manuscript refers to Charles II, a different character. This part of the legends may be of significance, for the French Masons claimed a legendary grant by Charles Martel of perpetual exemption from the guard or watch duty. Some manuscripts completely omit mention of Charles Martel, possibly because of his unpopularity with the church. So, Martel, M-A-R-T-E-L, go and Google that and have your way with it. And I'm going to give a little plug here for the Petra Stones review. If you haven't visited it today, please, by all means. It is one of the premier bits of work, a review of Freemasonry, sponsored by the Quattro Coronate Lodge, number 2076. This, I think, is remarkable, and for the quality of the work and consistency, I've never seen anything. You perhaps have, but I've never seen anything finer. And have at it. Check it out and have at it. The internet brings that to your fingertip, no matter where you are. Now we're crushing through the second similarity, peculiarities and differences and things. So illustrating how significant some of the minor errors or variations may be, there is cited the instance where one of the manuscripts in the Latin sentence described how the oath is to be taken, and it uses the words el, vel, illa, he or she. Oh, our Latin coaches will just be hemorrhaging right now. Again, I'm a poor student. They use the gender he or she, leading to the conclusion in the minds of some writers that women were accepted into the fraternity. But comparisons with other manuscripts shows this to have been a mere clerical error in copying ille, vel, ille, he or they. There you go. Small, small variation. An I instead of an A. He or she, he or they. I-L-L-E, she, I-L-L-I. Easy to do. If you still write script in longhand, yeah. While women were admitted to most of the craft guilds, and while it seems that in certain instances, widows of deceased master masons were allowed to continue the business with the aid of a Freemason and were entitled to certain privileges of the craft, nevertheless, the character of the Mason's work renders it improbable that women were ever admitted to full membership. Ever, even in the guilds, and there is no record or other indication that they were ever accepted in the lodges. Third, of outstanding interest is the legendary advent of Masonry in England and the inauguration of general assemblies by Athelstane or Edwin of Northumberland. If the event took place in the reign of Athelstane, it occurred between 920 and 940. But so far as Edwin's role is concerned, it must have occurred 3 centuries earlier. Such anachronisms are not unusual in the legends, as illustrated by the story that Abraham, who lived 2,000 years B.C., instructed Euclid, who lived 300 years A.D. you have to take you have to stretch the imagination. You're bringing together concepts. You're bringing together the concept here of Abraham and the concept of Euclid. So if we say we personify this and say, well, they were men, well, think about it. We're going beyond the lifetime. We get into notions of immortality of the idea. The ideas continue, man to man to man, mouth to ear. There is nothing inherently improbable about the advent of masonry or geometry into England in the 10th century or even the 7th. It is quite possible that the author of the first of the constitution simply chose at random two outstanding early rulers, Athelstan being the first English king to assert with confidence sovereignty over the whole of Britain, and Edwin being famed as a Christian church builder. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? I'm going to tell the story, and I have to compress hundreds of years of history. So where would I start? The minutiae? I want to tell you a story about Dale Graham. You know? No, you're going to pick the major, most significant leaders and movers and shakers that have passed the test of time. Man, it's a different world when you think beyond celebrity, isn't it? What we have going on around us today. You think about, well, if in history, if we look back 100 years, pick the men of character. It's easier done, isn't it? We don't see their shortcomings. What we see is the greatness of the people, the greatness of the idea. That's what builds our civilizations. We build on greatness, not shortcoming. And if the idea is that we're imperfect, well, you're sort of saying like, yeah, okay, the sun comes up. You're saying stuff that's obvious, but why play with it? You get your hands out of your pockets and quit playing with that idea. Let it go. We know it's there. Good grief, you know. With the lessons our mothers taught us, don't play with that thing. You go blind. Get over it. Yeah, we're imperfect. How many times do you think, okay, thank you. I've woken up again. Thank you for whispering that to me. You know, I might have forgot. Jeez. I'm a bloody Leafs fan. Leave me be. I'm a Mason. I know I'm imperfect. I've got work to do. Shh. Let me get at it. And if you've got something useful to say that might help me do this better or show where I'm not using my chisel and hammer properly, it would really help a lot. And by the way, since you're pointing all of this out, could you show me how to do it right? Not preach at me. Show me how to do it. I'm not daft. I have my daft moments, but, you know, the only thing that seems to matter at my age is when I hear something that's authentic, not something that's packaged by some wag or somebody, you know, God, somebody saying stuff that's just malarkey and covering it up with bad temper. Oh, gee, I better run and throw a sheet over my bloody head. Grow up. Sorry, a little tirade. I get to do that sometimes, you know. Excuse me, I'm not the only one listening to this that ever does that. Excuse me. I love you guys. Here's a third, an outstanding... There's nothing inherently improbable about the advent of masonry or geometry into England. Yet none of the ancient manuscripts pretend to set a date for the first general assembly at York until we come to the comparatively recently Inigo Jones manuscript dated 1607, but probably written in 1725, which fixes the York assembly at 932. But Dr. Anderson, in his Constitutions of 1738, for the first time gave the date as 926. His reason for the change is unknown. That's the York Assembly. Go and dig into that. Especially those of you who recognize and respect that the capitular masonry is a completion of the third degree. Separate, better? No. The question of date is, however, trivial compared to the question of whether any general assembly of Masons was ever held prior to the General Lodge era.
According to the legends, the charter provided for general assemblies once a year, and the chargers enjoined the craftsmen to attend if they knew where it was to be held, they being within 50 miles of the site. Some of the manuscripts say 40 miles, others 10, 7, or 5 miles. Dr. Anderson evidently assumed that such general assemblies were held and that they constituted grand lodges. Hence, he called the Grand Lodge of 1717 the revival of a Grand Lodge which had fallen into decay. A general assembly, if held, was quite different from a Grand Lodge, which is a representative body composed of officers or delegates of lodges as well as Grand Lodge officers. But the general assembly mentioned in the legend was a meeting of the whole body of the craft. It is significant that except for the Gothic legends, there is no other record to sustain the theory of the general assemblies of Masons. Gould concluded that no such Masonic general assembly ever was held and based his findings on a study of the medieval custom of annual franc pledge and of the judicial system of England at that period. He held that the separate or special assemblies of Masons mentioned in the legends were simply and only the annual meetings of the Sheriff's Turn, Shire Court, or Court Leet. Sheriff's Turn is two words, T-U-R-N, Shire Court, or Court Leet, Court L-E-E-T, where men of all crafts were required to appear each year and take or renew their franc pledge or oath of allegiance. Since the Masons were required, according to the legends, to travel no more than 50 miles, and since a circle within that radius could have included but a small part of the nation, the idea of one national assembly is greatly, if not entirely, discredited. What we're hearing here from Coyle is the logistics just don't add up. Good story, though. It doesn't take away from the story. You know, it'd be like, you know, you do the myths and the fables and fairy tales not tell us important messages? You're damn right they do. They help define us as a culture. And so do ours. No apology. No apology. Get with the program. Start to study it. Oh, if you're on the outside looking in, you're not going to perhaps have the same visceral, emotional, soulful connection to the importance of the lessons. And so be it. That's not our issue. Then we find the statue 3, Henry the Sixth, chapter 1 of 1425, which begins with the recital, whereas but the yearly congregation and confederacies made by the Masons in their general chapters assembled, etc., which Gould labors to explain as relating solely to unlawful assemblies for fixing wage contrary to the statute of laborers. So we don't want any of that rabble organizing, meeting privately and talking about fair wages, do we? We want that to be set by the state. Well, we all know where that went. And let me say, it did not go well for the state, in case you've slept through that part of your history lessons. The laws changed from time to time as the legal system of England developed. Maybe that was before Bannockburn, wasn't it? Yeah. And the records describing it are so scant and the whole matter so obscure that no positive conclusion can be drawn. If you think today, now this was written a while ago, you think today you can do better than this? Not as a matter of hubris. No, certainly not. This is copyrighted in 1967, so, right? Written by Henry Wilson Coyle, 1966. So, yeah, it's been a while. So if there's new findings, go out and find it. If you do, send it in so I can share it with everybody else. But at this time, we're saying it's inconclusive. No positive conclusion. So when we hear somebody drawing a positive conclusion, put it in that context, brethren. It is quite possible that in very early times, separate craft assemblies were held local rather than national scope. Now that makes some sense. And that during that period, references to them became embodied in the legends where they remained until long after the custom lapsed or was abandoned. possibly as early as the 14th century. It does seem incredible that general assemblies could have existed in the 17th century, extending up to a time approaching the organization of the Grand Lodge in 1717, without some extraneous mention of them having been preserved. A fourth similarity. The charges vary in number and arrangement, though little in substance. The Regius manuscript sets forth 15 articles for the master and 15 points for the craftsman. The Cook manuscript, 9 for the master and 9 for the craft. The Grand Lodge manuscript contains 2 groups, 9 general and 18 special charges, both kinds apparently addressed to the masters and fellows indiscriminately, and other manuscripts contain similar variations. Harleian manuscript number 1942 of about 1670 and a few of the same family set forth 25 charges and then add 6 new articles, which are not found in any of the constitutions prior to the middle of the 17th century. These, in brief, required that a lodge consist of at least 5 Freemasons, that a sojourning Mason bring with him a certificate from the lodge that had accepted him, showing the time of his exception, and the names of Masons be enrolled on a parchment, and that an oath of secrecy be taken, the form of which is prescribed. That was 1670. These new articles indicate that the administration of the lodges had been loose and that they were, therefore, imposed upon by unqualified pretenders. You've often wondered why a Grand Lodge? What impetus? Now, do you mind if I add a little bit of history here that you may not have heard listening to FM radio? This has to do with Anderson. And not to detract from the work, but again, context. Anderson was a Scotsman, right? Ask yourself, why do you think the Masons of London would ask the Scotsman to do something as important as construct the Constitution? Well, there is a reason. First, we can't tell definitively that Anderson was ever initiated as a Mason. Now, that's not to say he didn't have knowledge that was useful to Masonry. Now, remember, things were a bit looser, a bit different at the time. Different era, eh? But there is something that was happening in Scotland that may have given him knowledge, special knowledge, that would be useful to an emerging Grand Lodge. And here it is. Did you know that you've heard about Kilwinning Lodge? Well, did you know that before the existence of the Grand Lodge, Kilwinning was already chartering other lodges? Yes, it's true. Kilwinning is in the Glasgow province of the districts in Scotland are divided into provinces, and it is the only lodge that has its own province. The Kilwinning province, 1. Curious, hey? All the others have clusters, different numbers of lodges. I think in total, if I'm not mistaken, correct me here, there are 44 lodges within the Glasgow province, but Kilwinning is altogether of their own, and they had the work of chartering other lodges. So you think about it, the map, they had the map. They had this process and system. So if you and I were setting up a Grand Lodge and scratching our head and saying, well, this has never been done before. Hey, those boys up in Glasgow, those boys up in Scotland, they've got something that might, probably help us a great deal. Now, you would also know that Kilwinning has a province. It has stability. So this is a fly by night. This isn't like, oh, gee, let's come up with something that works today. This was a bona fide. Now, if I was trying to do something in another country, I would probably research the strongest information, the most valuable information I could, no matter where it was on the planet. And so you knock on the door of James Anders, a Scottish Presbyterian minister. the Kirk was formidable in both the social and political existence of Scotland. These are not people that trivialize the importance, the significance of the rights of people, not a bit, in your Scottish history. So was there an influence? I'm convinced there was. It's not so important to me truly whether Anderson was a Freemason. He hung around with a very interesting man, De Saulier. Go and study him. He was a very, very interesting mind. Royal Society, you know, consummate scientist, and made major contributions to science that are still with us today, and second Grand Master of the Grand Lodge, United Grand Lodge, Grand Lodge of England? In fact, Grand Lodge of London, because Masonry, you know, read Rutherford's, I don't want to get into this, but read Rutherford's book on London. It's a great historical novel, fills you full of all kinds of information about the history of, and if you want the companion to that, really the first part of that is Sarum, S-A-R-U-M, Edwin Rutherford. You can get it at used bookstores. It's just a fabulous read. It sits on my bookshelf, and if you're looking in Sarum, you're going to see references to old architecture that I've never seen anywhere else. Rutherford is an author that is known for the accuracy, his historical accuracy. So you will see him describing techniques for building the foundation, setting out the foundation for the ancient cathedrals. Absolutely, absolutely riveting for the likes of you and I. That's Sarum and the companion piece, the latter piece, London. Take a look at that. Now, have I dug myself into a pit here? Not a bit. So I'm putting into the context here that there was earlier knowledge. And, of course, we're going to use the early knowledge. And I suppose everybody's out there saying today everybody brags about their newest, shiniest, whatever. And then there's still some of us that say, look at that craft. I was out with some wonderful fellows and we're looking at old planes, planes that had helped us during the war. And you just look at the craftsmanship and the ingenuity. It's remarkable. Some people admire that kind of sense of workmanship. Other people, it's only what's new. I can't help them. I guess I don't know what they do when they look at old sculpture. I'm not a big fan of contemporary sculpture here in Canada, but that's my bias, I guess. I'll live with that one. So we know that the administration of lodges had been loose. And there was we had pretenders coming in, you know. So it makes some sense. The operative activities having diminished, there was no danger, the same self-interest to the Mason to protect the building secrets, those having been displaced by mere ritualistic secrets. And evidently the practice of one or two Masons making other Masons, as later became quite a scandal, was already regarded as objectionable, so that five Masons, few enough certainly, were required to form a lodge. Did you know that? There was a time when the practice was two of us could get together and we could make a Mason. You'd imagine if it was two of the finest minds. You know, you just think about some of the wonderful, exceptional people we know in the craft here in Ontario. If you picked two of the best minds, you would think the product would be exceptional. But there are others in the Masonic classroom that were slumbering in the back row. And if they produced a Mason, the variation in the quality would be unacceptable. Quite frankly, unacceptable. Thank you, Andrew Hammer, for reminding us. We're the skilled craftsman. We're the master mason. We are the people that are going to maintain the quality. Not with this muscular silliness. This is right. This is wrong. It's a mindset. And it's to be done and handled with a sense of gentility and dignity. That's something that we seem to have difficulty with here in Ontario. We're so concerned that everything has to be brought to a common level. And being on the level is not the lowest common denominator. I'm sorry. Common level, being on the level, is to struggle to get to the highest level. And if you're not there, you're not working hard enough. There's a little line from Cyril. If you've got enough time to complain, you're not working hard enough. That's my grandfather, very worshipful brother, Cyril Snowden Tombs of Prince Edward Island. You hear complaints around you? That's a boy that's not working hard enough. He may not be working hard enough, but that doesn't mean you need to put down your tool and sit there slack-jawed and listening to him. Get on with your business. Be diligent, but carry yourself with dignity. Why are we so afraid of that? Why are we so shy about rank? Some amongst us. I think that if there were more pomp and circumstance, that it wouldn't kill us, that it would bring a different definition of respect to our high offices. And that, I don't think, would kill us. And for me to be able to accept that I'm a member of the rank and file, that doesn't kill me either. That's what I hope for. That's what I strive for. That whatever the rank or privilege, I have work to do. So do you. And I'm not going to walk around saying, you've got to do your work. You know, we're not, it's not a sing-song. But you can see the need to standardize, because there were charlatans, there were people doing their own thing, spinning this is their version of Freemasonry, this is their version of initiation. So you can see the need, I can certainly see the need for standardization. But we can also see the benefit, the wisdom of going and knocking on the door of some of the, you know, fellows that had exposure to co-winning and saying, you know, how do you fellows do it? And what do you look for? You know, standardization. If standardization is genius, if standardization is the quality of the Royal Society, the highest level, then we're not saying you have to produce a widget that looks the same and measures the same and sounds the same. Far from it. Depends how we define standardization or how we define democracy. Are we to all say the same thing at the same time in the same posture? How mind-numbing. It's getting it. It's getting it. I can only think that we're at a, think of it, we're at a huge concert. And there's some malcontent sitting there sulking. Oh, this isn't my kind of, I don't like this kind of. Well, man, get with the energy. Look around. Get with the program. This is no place for a malcontent. Be quiet. Go sit down. Don't embarrass yourself. But, you know, it's one other thing to say, you know, the performance wasn't up to what I thought it would be. But just being able to pull something off on a large scale, doesn't that mean anything? And to do it for hundreds of years, it's harder today than it was at the start, I will say. Because at the start, the boys weren't, they had history, but they were sort of trying to pull it together and say, you know, what now? Where the hell does all this come from? And you know, writing it first, designing it is a lot harder than that's a separate, very, very difficult task. Being able to maintain that greatness, man, that takes genius. That takes genius. You know, the genius. Where do I see it in the world? I see it in laboratories, like you see the work and the diligence of my very good friend and very honorable brother Gareth, just exceptional work, just exceptional. You can see the product, how it takes so many great minds to produce that. Or I get the same kind of feeling when I tune in something from the Metropolitan Opera, just to be able to produce something like that. Like all the little bits and things going on in the background, it's like you hold your breath, the curtain goes up, and then it works, and it's like, whoa. Well, that's the kind of spine-tingling sense I get about Freemasonry. We need to be able to realize that we're here because we have something to offer. And we can all be walking around like stagehands. Well, you know, we get off the stage, we're all stagehands. We're all there to move props and scenery around. Well, some. We get as many of those as we need, but we've got a lot of that. And management, well, we've got 43,000 middle managers. That's always helpful when you're trying to do something useful. Yeah, well, I don't have to do anything. I just don't agree. Well, then step aside. This isn't the place for you. This isn't the party for you. Why'd you join? What the hell are you doing? Go find something else to do. Go chase a stick. Here, I'll throw you a stick. Here, the idea is to get with the program. Or more politely, be single-minded. Not numb. Not watering it down. Exceptional. And if we're not that, then to respect those that are. Not those that pretend. You know, this isn't about pretending. Go and get a ticket to the Phantom of the Opera if you want to see pretense. The diva that can't hit the notes, doesn't have the personality and wants to be at center stage because she has been for a while. And the ingenue that's being brought in that doesn't have the support but has the talent. And what does the Phantom do? He's in love with this voice. Only he exists in the shadows, lives in shame. Scarred. So go and watch that if you want a Masonic lesson, I would say. Think about it. Or think about the background at, pick your favorite type of music. We have the advantage of all of it right now. Think about, I was just listening to some material by Brian Aubrey. Just incredible jazz coming out of some of them, and he's reminding us that some of the brilliant jazz is coming out of the late 20s and 30s. Well, when you hear it today, it's like just absolutely stunning. Just stunning. So those are things that teach us about the genius and how we pull it together. Well, this is an audience. This is a congregation where we're pulling together bright people. And we have to be taught how to work together. We have to learn to sing in a chorus. Yes, of course. But we also have to learn the different functions. We have to learn what the different instruments are about and what they add to the symphony. If Reba's a goddess, Reba McEntire, she steps on stage without proper lighting, well, it's not quite the same. And if her musicians aren't at their best, it's not quite the same. The costumes, the lighting, the atmosphere, it's stunning. And when she speaks and she sings and performs, it's like she's singing to me alone. Nobody else around. How does that happen? So does it matter that there was somebody that has to tape the bundles of wire together and make sure the hydraulics for a stage are in order? You bet. And they make it look brilliant because they make it look easy. And they feel great about it because they're making a contribution to something amazing, once in a lifetime, every one of these performances. So every single time you come together to do ritual, keep that notion in mind. This is a once in a lifetime. If the brethren are blinking and nodding off, think about, are we treating it the same way? Here we go again. I'm sorry, I make no apologies to degree mills. That's all the lodges are doing. Well, you know, I make no apology. They're adrift. Absolutely adrift. So I'm thinking differently about the direction of the craft and the things that you notice. Just sit back in the back row and pay attention. Boy, if you sit quietly, there's amazing amounts of things that you begin to notice going on. And I know there are times when each one of you shares that kind of excitement. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You've been there. You're still there. You go into a lodge and you bring that with you. You bring that excitement. You bring that energy. It's that connection. Only it's either that you need it or you want it. But by our obligations, we are to make those two things the same. To achieve that, here we go with the fifth, the obligation of compliance. Aha! Getting with the program, eh? At least when I go to a performance, I don't have to necessarily give an oath of compliance to that. We're a little deeper than, and I apologize if anybody thinks that I'm trivializing our craft. I certainly mean no disrespect. But it's that, I think it's that energy, you know, that symbiosis, that rapport with what's going on our life stage. The level for me is not the lowest common, where the dregs and the simple and the lazy are treated with the same accolades as the best. Nope, I'm sorry. Nope. The lazy and indifferent are treated as lazy and indifferent, and they don't stop the brilliance from going on. Never did, never have. They're just an annoyance. And I don't think that's changed. Let's check this out from the fifth similarity of the Gothic constitutions and see. The obligation or oath of compliance bound the mason to observe the charges. This usually concluded with, so help you God and his holy dome. Some copies using Halidome. Halidome, H-A-L-Y-D-O-M-E or H-A-L-L-I-D-O-M, or Holy Dome. It has never been determined what this expression denotes, though it is said to be a Saxon word meaning holy judgment. And that, by my Halidome, was a solemn oath among the rural population of early England. By my Halidome. By my holy judgment. The new articles of 1670 add the oath of secrecy, which ends with, so help me God and the holy contents of this book. One manuscript uses the holy scriptures, another by God's grace, and still a third, by one or more laying his hand on the book and swear by one command and oath. These old heirlooms of the craft permit almost limitless speculation, but they also raise perplexing questions. It is difficult to say whether the general uniformity of the many versions or their specific divergences are the more curious. Some of the divergences can be explained only on the theory that the manuscripts were reproduced from memory, but it would seem that even the most treacherous memory, starting with 9 articles for the master and 9 points for the craftsman, would not wind up with 9 general points and 18 special points for both the masters and fellows jointly. Such changes must have been deliberate. But why? He was a good mason. Means nothing to you until you begin to ask why and what it says to you. With the ritual, what does it say to you? What does it mean? That's how the eyes start to wake up. Like, what's going on? And why do these other people seem so excited about it? Oh, I don't like it. This is different. This is like ochre. Or this is like chitlins. Oh, I don't like it. It's different. This is like gravy on my biscuits. Oh, I don't like that. I've never had that before. This is like lobster. Oh, I don't like that. I've never had that before. This is like a 18-year-old single malt. This is like French roast coffee. Yes. This is like creme brulee. This is like haggis. Or goose at Christmas. Or like my friend Al used to have, a Scandinavian fellow. He's from Sweden. Herring, pickled herring. I don't like it. It's different. Yeah, sometimes we act like children. Develop your taste, for goodness sakes. I don't like it. I have to wear a tie. So you look good in a tie. Some of the divergencies can be explained only on the theory that the manuscripts were reproduced from memory. And it would seem that even the most treacherous, starting with 9 articles and 9 points, there's been changes. They stretched to 9 and then 18 for both It was deliberate. George F. Ford expressed the opinion that the authorship of the missing originals of these old manuscripts went back at least to AD 1200, for the reason that the charges often refer to the hewing of stones, the shaping of freestone having been done with an adze up to about that time. I think you know what an adze is. Kind of interesting. I don't know how those boys did it without cutting their feet, but they did. When it was displaced by the use of the chisel. Up close and personal, eh? Maybe, of course, the chisel would be a little more accurate. A little more accurate meant a little more ornamentation. It is to be noted that the Cook manuscripts mention old books of masonry, plainly indicating earlier transcripts of the constitutions. It is impossible to account for the peculiar form of the legends. In part, they are of scriptural or patriarchal cast, possibly reflecting the purpose of some priest or monk to further religious practices. There is also incorporated a purely mathematical or scientific strain in the characters of Euclid, Hermes, and Pythagoras. Then a royal touch is added by Charles Martel, Athelstan, and Edwin. Regardless of the authority for or the accuracy of the legends, they have to, in large measure, become indelibly impressed upon Freemasonry. I think that we need to be able to get into the legend of Hiram, the Hiramic legends and the Noahic legends. I won't get too far ahead in this. Regardless of the authority for or the accuracy of their legends, there have been in large measure because they have become indelibly impressed upon Freemasonry. The temple legend, somewhat modified and expanded, has become a part, and some say an indispensable part, of the ritual. The name York Rite is firmly attached to the English or original stem of Masonry, even as it was carried into other lands, and the three main aspects of the legends, religious, scientific, and royal, have persisted fairly to the present day. Despite all the imperfections which higher criticisms has discovered in the legends, we may justly reverence the old charges, for out of the warp and woof of their behests have been woven the legends, regulations, rituals, and tenets of a world society which has gathered within its halls men of every country, sect, and opinion. And out of their simple ethical teachings, there has evolved a standard of morality to which men of good intention everywhere can subscribe. It's not to say all of us. Good men doesn't preclude good intention. What a striking illustration of the universality and perpetuity of moral laws is to observe the doctrines of the fraternity and rules of morality laid down in an age which in every other way differs so strikingly from our own, have remained for 500 years, 600 years, as bright as though newly coined. Ha ha! Absolutely fantastic. Are we seeing growth and change? Probably. Probably. We're going to get into, the next time we get together, we're going to get into the German Steinmetzen. That'll talk, you probably have heard a little bit about that. Now, that said, I want to we'll come back at that. Man, I find this interesting because it provides context. It helps understand what it is we're seeing and what it is we're hearing and what it is we're expected to learn today. So I hope that you've found it productive. We have to admit very little to the rest of the world. Freemasonry is one of the oldest secular fraternal societies. Freemasonry is a society of men concerned with moral and spiritual values. Freemasons are taught its precepts by a series of ritual dramas which follow ancient forms and use stonemasons' customs and tools as allegorical guides. The essential qualification to become Freemason is a belief in a supreme being. A Freemason's duty as a citizen must always prevail over any obligation to other Masons, and any attempt to shield Freemasons who
as acted dishonorably or unlawfully, or to confer an unfair advantage on other Freemasons is contrary to this prime duty. The Freemasons refer to those who are not Freemasons as Cowans, because in architecture, a Cowan is somebody apprenticed to bricklaying, but not licensed to the trade of masonry. Who knew? There you have a little bit of a wake-up. The body of Freemasonry is comprised of many types of individuals whose Masonic pursuits vary according to that individual's personality and interests. Freemasonry has been very aptly compared to a complex tapestry composed of many colorful, overlapping individual threads, which taken as a whole form a larger picture. Brother Mason Pratt developed a list of different brands of Freemasons based upon behavioral characteristics, which included, pick yourself out of this one, gentlemen, this is a list, the socialite, the historian, the ritualist, philosopher, Masonic law, symbolism, and collector. Now, this is from a guide for the New Esoteric Freemason by Brother William Steve Burkle. And he adds to the list charitable and fiduciary. I suspect that most of us can think of brothers in our own lodge who fit one of these diverse profiles. Esoteric Freemasons usually fit into one or more of these brand categories, although historian, ritualist, symbolist, and symbolism and philosopher are the most common. Every initiated Freemason, however, is a potential esoteric Mason, since all Freemasons seek illumination through the initiation process. It is this quest for light revealed through the comprehension of hidden spiritual knowledge which distinguishes the esoteric Freemason, and it defines esoteric Masonry. Esoteric Freemasonry is not for everyone, not even for everyone who receives the gift of illumination. This is in no way a reflection upon the character or works of Masons who, for various reasons, find themselves disinclined to pursue the esoteric path. Unfortunately, there are many Masons who pronounce that there simply is no esoteric content at all to be had in Freemasonry, even though Masonic ritual is ripe with evidence to the contrary. It's amazing. Some Grand Lodges openly discount esotericism and discount esoteric Freemasonic pursuits to be the substance of fringe Freemasonry. Fringe Masonry is actually a term which is legitimately reserved for specific non-Masonic organizations which usually have been founded by individuals who may also happen to be Freemasons and which explore exclusively esoteric and mystical topics. These organizations typically have a system of progressive degrees and are often structured in a manner which reflects the Masonic influence. Examples include the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and the Ordo Templi Orientis. The National Heritage Museum maintains a small collection of occult texts which are accurately classified under the heading of fringe Masonry. It should be noted that the term fringe is applied to these as applied does not imply that their tradition or curriculum is bogus or without merit. In modern times, we would simply use a more accurate term, quasi-Masonic, in lieu of the word fringe. It is difficult to determine the extent to which attempts to disavow the esoteric nature of the craft stem from ignorance, and which are an ongoing reaction to the anti-Masonic movements of the early 1800s. It is interesting to consider that over the past three centuries, the reputation of worldwide Freemasonry has suffered the greatest blows from allegations of treason in England, which culminated in the Unlawful Societies Act of 1799, allegations of murder associated with the Morgan Affair in 1826, and perceived challenges to the authority of the Church resulting in Pope Leo XIII issuing a papal encyclical known as the Hermannum Genus of 1884. Note that unless one considers that the Templar persecution, for which charges of heresy have since been refuted, specific allegations of occultism have never played a significant role in inflicting lasting damage or discredit to the craft. Even in today's world of internet access, such misinformation has not been effective in spite of a seemingly endless stream of sensational allegations of occultism levied by critics of the order. This is because, for the most part, these allegations are so fantastic as to be laughable, and on the whole obvious as nonsensical rants of the ignorant. Truth is, esoteric Freemasonry is a growing trend. The reasons for this are numerous. However, the two most common that men coming into the craft are in search of a type of spiritual experience which they find lacking in their current religious and secular paths, and that the Dan Brown series of novels and films have piqued their interest in esotericism. These men believe that Freemasonry is the path to greater esoteric knowledge. Sadly, they often go away disappointed. So esotericism is a term which literally means hidden. Although it is synonymous with the term occult, it is currently the preferred term used when discussing the arcane meanings present in Masonic ritual. In large part because of the negative connotations of which the word occult has acquired in connection with scary Hollywood movies and inept journalistic reporting of gruesome pseudo-occult crimes, which could more properly be characterized as bizarre or deranged rather than as truly occult. That which the truly occult hides is knowledge, usually knowledge considered sacred or knowledge maintained sacred because it could result in the persecution of those who possess it. I will not belabor this point further other than to point out that history is filled with examples of persons persecuted for holding beliefs which are contrary to the beliefs and interests of those in authority, or even suspected of holding such beliefs. Freemasonry is often described as a system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. An allegory can be simply described as a story with two meanings. In the New Testament of the Christian Bible, for example, allegory or parable was used extensively by Christ. In Freemasonry, we expand the definition of allegory to include metaphoric content which exists in our ritual, our tradition, and our symbolism. And as our friend Willie Leslie Wilmhurst wrote, "Our teaching is purposely veiled in allegory and symbol, and its deeper import does not appear upon the surface of the ritual itself. This is partly in correspondence with human life itself and the world we live in, which are themselves but allegories and symbols of another life and the veils of another world." It's been great having you join me today, brethren and guests. I hope this has been useful. I look forward to having you join us again real soon. I'll be back in a week. I always prefer to believe the best of everybody. It saves so much trouble. That was Rudyard Kipling. All the people like us are we, and everybody else is they. And as he said, an ounce of mother is worth a pound of clergy. He travels the fastest who travels alone. If I were hanged on the highest hill, mother o' mine, O mother of mine, I know whose love would follow me still, mother of mine, O mother of mine. He wrapped himself in quotations as a beggar would enfold himself in the purple of emperors. I'll see you soon. Never look backwards or you'll fall down the stairs. Bye for now.